it please the court, I'm Robert Long, representing the American Petroleum Institute. In 2010, and again in 2011, EPA projected that millions of gallons of cellulosic biofuel would be available under the Renewable Fuel Program. In fact, not a single gallon of cellulosic biofuel was available in either year, and as a result, obligated parties had to pay millions of dollars to EPA. Despite this experience, EPA projected that millions of gallons of cellulosic biofuel would be available in 2012. Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is said to be a form of insanity. EPA's cellulosic...
You aren't here proposing that EPA be limited to the number achieved in the prior year, are you?
Well, what we're proposing is that EPA has to make a reasonable projection, and that's what EPA itself says it has to do. Now, the experience so far has been that this is a very difficult technical challenge. And so far, there has not been any success in producing cellulosic biofuel in commercial quantities. So I think projecting that there would be no production in 2012 would have been reasonable. It's possible that EPA could have justified a larger prediction than zero, but our primary submission is that by making no adjustment for the predictable setbacks and delays that have happened to every single facility that's trying to produce this new kind of fuel, and by rejecting even the adjustment that EIA, the Energy Information Agency, which is the agency that is expert, has expertise in making these kinds of predictions.
But you don't want to be bound by their prediction either.
Well, Your Honor, they do build in, the way they do it is they say if the facility is not physically complete by the beginning of the year, we will project 25% of capacity for the year. If it's not complete by the middle of the year, we'll project no production for the year. Now, that has turned out to be inaccurate, too, very inaccurate. Mm-hmm. But at least they are acknowledging that there are going to be predictable setbacks and delays in producing this entirely new, very difficult type of fuel.
The predictable setbacks and delays don't lead necessarily to a definitive number. And thus, I'm not sure... We're talking about projections, predictions, speculative judgments. I don't know how we can say exactly where EPA has to pick, and I'm not hearing much from you about what's the specific top number they could have picked here. You said they can go above zero. Right?
Well, it's got to be below. They have to justify going above zero, and
they justify it here on the basis of the projections of the individual facilities, and they look at what EIA said, and then it's a projection. It's going to be inherently, it could be wrong.
And that's really what we're asking this court to intervene on. We're not asking this court to set a specific number or a ceiling. We think what is clearly unreasonable is for year after year to say, well, we will essentially take the predictions of these facility owners at face value. We will build in nothing for setbacks or delays. If they at least took the EIA number, then they'd be building in something. And as you say, that has not turned out well either. But that would at least be more rational. That would be closer to a rational approach. So we're not asking this court to set a specific number or a ceiling. We're asking this court to require EPA to learn from experience, to face up to the reality here, and to make some sort of reasonable recognition of the fact that this is a product that's never been produced in commercial quantities, and so far it's proving to be a very, very difficult challenge.
Why can't EPA, when looking at this situation which you describe, say that we're going to take into account a market forcing objective as well, and thus within the range of possible outcomes, say we're going to pick at the higher end of the range?
Well, for two reasons, I think. First of all, Congress told them to project what will be produced, and I think that means make a fair projection that is what will actually be produced, not something that they think would be a good number for some other policy reason. Mm-hmm. But even as a matter of policy, suppose they set a number that turned out to be too low. I mean, we're many miles away from that now, but suppose it happened. The RINs, that when you produce this renewable fuel, you get these RINs, would be highly valuable, and someone would buy them because they're good not only for the year in which they're produced, but for the next year, too. And someone would want to buy them in order to help fulfill their requirements for the following year. So it's not true that if they set the requirement a bit too low, that would result in not enough incentives to produce. The incentives are there, the incentives that Congress set. So for both of those reasons, I don't think it's an acceptable answer that, well, we would want to set a high number just to give people an extra incentive to produce. So that's...
We know what's happened in 2012. We had in the last few months, I guess we had the stats up to...
As of November 7th, EPA is showing that about 20,000 gallons of cellulosic fuel have been produced, but that actually cannot be used to satisfy the requirement because it was a special situation. It was not any of the facilities that they were predicting would produce something, and it was exported to Brazil for a special conference. And when fuel is exported, that means it doesn't count against the cellulosic requirement.
What was the conference going to do with the fuel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What was the conference going to do with the fuel? You said it was exported for a conference. That seems astonishing.
Well, it was for, I think, for a conference on renewable fuels, a special Rio conference.
People could see samples?
Sorry?
People could see, so that people could see samples?
Well, I honestly don't know what they did with it once they got it to Brazil, but the important thing is when it's exported, then it actually creates an additional obligation, so the 20,000 gallons cannot be used.
No, I understand your basic point. It's just very curious.
Looking at the language of the statute, just one thing jumped out at me. You focus on the based on the estimate, but it does say before that, as determined by the administrator based on the estimate, which does, as you're aware, under our precedent, suggests, underscores the deference to the administrator here, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, Congress did say based on the EIA's estimate, and the EIA is the expert agency, so I don't think this is the typical case where the court would give a lot of deference to the expert agency, because we have another expert agency that really is the expert in making these kinds of predictions. And although their predictions have also turned out to be...
What makes them more expert than EPA on this?
Well, the Energy Information Agency, its main purpose is to collect information about production of different kinds and to make predictions about future production. Mm-hmm. EPA's primary purpose, of course, is environmental issues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to the extent one agency is more expert, I would say it's EIA.
And how do you expect them to get behind the facility predictions? So the facility says, the different facilities say, this is what we're projecting. How much does EPA have to do to start challenging
that? There are different ways they could do that. I mean, first of all, since Congress had based this on what EIA does, you know, EIA has its own approach. They could essentially start with the EIA projection. That's what we think they should do.
You aren't using start with in a chronological sense, as I understand it, from your reply brief.
Well, we don't think
because
they have to start.
EIA only offers its projection after the EPA has started on it.
That's not quite true, Your Honor. I mean, EIA has a preliminary number, as I understand it, But really, you know, this is what Congress said. They said to base it on the EIA projection, and they set a one-month difference. But in terms, Judge Kavanaugh, of getting behind what the individual facilities do, I mean, EIA has developed one approach, which is to say, look, we've observed this over the years, and we'll come up with these utilization percentages based not on predictions of the facility owners at all, but just on capacity and when they finish physical construction. So that would be one approach, and it appears from experience that those numbers need to be even lower because it hasn't been working out over and over again. But that's one way to do it, and you could you could start with the facility owner's projections but make adjustments off of that. There are a number of ways, and again, we're not asking the court to impose a particular approach on the agency. What we're saying is we went through this in 2010. We went through it again in 2011. Here we are in 2012, and year after year, EPA is just saying, well, these facilities that have never produced any of this product, and every single one of them that has tried to so far has failed completely, but nevertheless.
But you say we don't have to pick a number or set an upper range, but if I would be uncomfortable sending it back without some guidance to the agency other than just try again. I realize sometimes we do that, but it's generally better if we give them some parameters to what.
Well, I mean, if the parameter I would suggest is to say, you know, based on all the evidence we have, 2010, 2011, what changed between the notice of proposed rulemaking in 2012 and the final rule in 2012, all of that experience shows that no one has been able to produce any of this. So all of that supports a projection of zero for 2012. If the agency has a basis for predicting more, I think that's open to them. Again, what is mainly frustrating to the industry and has brought us to the court today is that there is just no recognition, none at all, of these predictable setbacks and delays.
We are almost at the end of 2012, so what would you want the court to do here, to vacate this or just to remand it for better explanation?
We think we would suggest vacating it, and it is difficult, but I would say, I mean, this is happening every year. 2013 is coming up. This year, EPA never put out a proposal for comment. Its deadline for issuing the final rule for 2013 was November 30th. Nothing has come out. So, I mean, I recognize the court is in somewhat of a difficult position, but so are the regulated entities. And if the EPA can simply say, well, this is only for a year and we need to be allowed to move on, this process could just continue over and over. So we're asking the court to intervene and to say there needs to be recognition that all the evidence suggests there are going to be setbacks and delays in actually producing this in commercial quantities. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Durkee from the U.S. Department of Justice. With me at council table is John Hannon from EPA's Office of General Counsel and John O'Quinn representing some of the interveners. I'd like to address some of the points that counsel raised, but before I get to that, if I could step back and give a framework of the argument, there's really three things at issue in this case. One of them we haven't touched on at all. There's jurisdiction, there's statutory construction, and then most of the questions have been about record support. The interveners raised jurisdiction. EPA chose not to in its brief, but on further reflection, I think the jurisdictional problem is real, and I think the court needs to consider it. Because despite counsel's characterization of EPA's approach, it really is no different. EPA did the same approach in 2011.
Well, did EPA in 2011 have any formula like this language at page 245 of the joint appendix? Our intention is to balance such uncertainty with the objective of promoting growth in the industry.
The 2011 rule, the proposal for 2011 is in what is a supplemental appendix, And EPA explained its how it approached how to set a cellulosic volume, essentially the same terms. If you go to supplemental appendix, I believe the proposal is in the 60s. July 20th, 2010 is the proposal. And there's, I believe, two places where EPA discusses how it's going to, what factors it's going to take into account. It's going to look at, for instance, at 64 to 65, the bottom of 64, column 3, as described in the final rule for the RFS2 program, that was 2010, we intend to examine EIS projected volume and other available data, including production outlook reports required under regulation and making the determination. It goes on the next page, supplemental appendix 65, under the table, the middle column, based on our preliminary assessment, we believe they announced their number for 2011 for the final rule. We'll use additional information that becomes available.
See, that's not the language.
What I don't see is anything paralleling this notion that the projection, which sounds as if Congress probably meant look for the truth, that instead EPA says here at page 245 that something is going to come into it, which is the objective of promoting growth. Now, everybody understands that that's the underlying objective of the whole exercise, but not of the discrete part of making a calculation. And one would think that normally, in the absence of something in the congressional language that said you're supposed to tilt it one way, you'd expect the projector to have to regard the risk of overshooting as no different from the risk of undershooting.
Well, two responses. One, the incentive is in the statute itself.
Yes, but there's no language that ties that to the determination of the projection.
Well, in addition, if you look at the final 2011 rule, which is also in the supplemental appendix, it's at in the 20s. If you go to 23 to 24, and this is in, I believe this is the EPA's brief. This is the intervener's brief at 14. They give these sites, 23 to 24 and 27. We've considered EIA's projection of cellulosic biofuel production and believe it's appropriate to set the volume at a level that provides an incentive for developing cellulosic biofuel facilities to come online as expeditiously as possible. And there's no reason surprising.
Where is this in the intervener's brief?
It's at 14 of their brief and the supplemental appendix 23 to 24 and then again 27. This is the December 2010 rule announcing the 2011 standards.
I mean, my eyes is hitting this passage that's quoted, page 14. Information we received in conversation with these companies, well, our assessment for the potential to produce cellulosic biofuel and the volumes indicated, that sounds like a sort of technocratic exercise.
Well, but
not a sort of missionary exercise.
Well, but if the question is, has EPA in 2011 expressed that the incentive and the technology forcing aspect is important, that's in the 2011 final rule. That's at, for instance, at supplemental appendix 27, column 1, the top of the column where it's the first full paragraph starts, we've considered EIA's projection, and it goes on to talk about the language I quoted, we believe it's appropriate to set it at a level that provides an incentive. So the idea of providing an incentive is not new, nor should it be surprising that it's new, because, as I said, that was Congress's intent. Congress, remember, set a volume, a presumptive volume of 500 million gallons of cellulosic for 2011, and both EIA and EPA dramatically went down from there. And the EIA's estimate and EPA's estimate are not that far off. They both are a fraction of the 500 million gallons, and when we turn to the specifics of facility by facility, EPA has record support that it clearly expresses in the rulemaking for where it differs and why. But the statutory interpretation question is EPA hasn't really changed its approach. It's always been the same approach. We're going to collect all the data we can. We're going to put it out there in a notice of proposed rulemaking. We're going to take the EIA's estimate when it comes in late in the year. We're going to factor those all together. Yes, we're going to consider that Congress wanted there to be an incentive, and then we're going to give our number. That has not changed from 2010 to 2011 to 2012. So the jurisdictional question is there too.
So you can't challenge, are you saying you can't challenge the number either?
No, the number is different. Okay. If there's record support for the number or not, then that's right. A separate question. Okay. But their first challenge is statutory interpretation.
Right.
That's too late. Mm-hmm. If you do reach the statutory interpretation question based on it is ambiguous. And in their brief, they, I think, concede that. In the reply brief, I think they walk backwards from that a little bit and say that it's actually...
What's your view of what EPA needs to do with the EIA estimate?
Well, I think it's EPA explained that in both 2011 and 2012, that it's a factor, and it's an important factor because the EIA, this is their job.
Why is it an important factor? It's like the sentencing guidelines in some respects. I don't understand what the agency really has to do here. Either it has to stay with the EIA estimate or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, your view is it doesn't, what's the relevance of the EIA estimate at all?
Well, I think in the context of an arbitrary...
You have to explain it, you have to acknowledge it, but then you can go somewhere else and pick
Well, for instance, if EPA has more recent information or more persuasive information for a particular company than the EIA had, then I think EPA would arguably be arbitrary to ignore that and just say, well, that's what the EIA said. So it's certainly not bound by it.
Now, what about the broader issue here that this just isn't happening? And it, after a few years of this, it becomes ridiculous to keep projecting something that's not happening.
Well, two responses. One, the obvious legal response, which Judge Williams, you articulated in the first case this morning, was it's a prediction. You can't undercut the prediction based on what happened.
But at some point, a prediction becomes absurd.
True. And that's why I think the court should focus its consideration on what EPA's explanation was in the rule for the facilities that it actually predicted production for.
The facilities have an incentive to come up with a higher number, right?
Well, they might to some extent, but I don't think that should be, I don't think much weight should be put on that because some of these facilities are publicly traded. They have to make statements.
Right.
They can't just say anything.
Right.
And also, if they did consistently inflate their numbers, then EIA and EPA both would, I think, quite rightly be a little suspicious of it. But that's not what happened. For one thing,
Is it right that 2012 has turned out to be basically nothing again?
20,000 is the correct number. Council is correct.
It doesn't count.
And it doesn't.
It doesn't count. That's right. The numbers were exported. I do not know. I also do not know why it was exported for use at a conference.
Doesn't this repeated overshooting also raise a question about the waiver argument? Because, you've called our attention to the word incentive in the 2011 projection process. Well, as time goes on, the evidence that this incentive goal is playing a big role in the intellectual process of EPA becomes gradually stronger. So, what seems like a stray term in one year begins to look like a driving force in a later year.
Well, I think one way to analyze that, Your Honor, is to look at is to compare what EPA projected and what the EIA projected. And if the EIA were projecting an extremely small number or zero, and EPA were projecting a very high number, there might be a better argument that EPA is not just looking at different information, but is maybe really trying to accomplish something else. But that's not the case here.
Well, EPA said it was trying to accomplish something else.
Well, yes, as I said earlier, and there's nothing wrong with that. EPA, there's I think maybe a semantic difference that is clouding the real distinction, which is, yes, EPA has to project what it thinks the production will be, but that still leaves a great range. That doesn't mean...
Yeah, but why shouldn't the goal of EPA under these circumstances be accuracy in the sense that overshooting and undershooting are weighted equally?
Well, I don't think they should be weighted equally because I think Congress gave clear direction that this is a fledgling
industry.
The
number, once it's picked, has to be bought by these people who have nothing to do with the actual production, right?
So
that itself creates the incentive. But I don't see anything in the actual language relating to determining the projected volume that says that EPA is supposed to have its thumb on the scale in a particular direction in that process.
Well, I think the
particularly
fact
when the people giving it its information don't bear any significant burden from overshooting.
The people, the obligated parties.
No, the beneficiaries of this process, yeah. The producers.
Well, I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the fact that there is a set market based on the number that EPA promulgates does give a benefit, even if particular companies aren't even.
They undoubtedly have a benefit from overshooting. They have no downside from. I'm sorry. They have a benefit from overshooting. They do, I guess, potentially lose from undershooting.
Right. This is really.
Well, not so much because of the point Mr. Long made, which is that the producers, particularly given EPA's track record, will be interested in buying up RINs in order to protect themselves for future years.
But also, this is a battle between two different industries. There's the petroleum-based industry, there's the renewable fuel industry, and I don't think it's a stretch to say that when Congress set very large volumes in the statute in 2007 all the way out to 2012, and then gave EPA, in this particular context of cellulosic biofuel, an explicit duty to examine whether that number year by year is right and make a waiver down to its projection, I don't think it's a stretch to say Congress was trying to force this fledgling injury that did not exist at the time. There was no such.
But it doesn't say that in the text. It does seem that Judge Williams says, the statutory text on this provision, this sentence, as compared perhaps to the next sentence, which says may also reduce, this sentence says shall reduce. And it does seem that Congress in that sentence was focused on getting the accurate projection, not a thumb on the scale. No?
Well, but it says the language is 7D.
Yeah.
Right.
For any calendar year for which the projected volume is less, right, as determined by the administrator based on the estimate, the administrator shall reduce. The next sentence, which is the other issue in the case, may also reduce, does imply a little more discretion here. It does seem that Congress, for good reason, recognized that there could be issues with the actual volume and said, project what it's going to be and reduce it thereby. It didn't say keep a thumb on the scale.
But if the projection, for instance, in API's comments, mm-hmm, in rulemaking, their comment wasn't, they didn't make this based on argument. What they said was, take the last 3 months of proven production, and that's what your number should be. You have to actually get production, mm-hmm, going before you can set a projection. But that it would be unreasonable for EPA to do that, and I think contrary to the statutory intent, because
interpretation of the statute, we're not limited to a specific methodology proposal by the petitioners.
No, well, for one thing, I think they've largely, I think, retreated from that position. But that was their position. That's not really the position they advance in their briefs. Now they're focusing more on the degree of deference to give to EIA. But in their comments, they're saying actual production. But I think EPA responded to that, saying that would not allow the industry to grow, because this is not a mature industry. Cellulosic biofuel is a fledgling industry that has just been created.
That still is no obstacle to trying to pursue a neutral methodology.
Well, that's true. If that were the issue in the case, interpreting that, which I think is not the key issue in the case, I don't think
that's because it's waived.
Yeah, they didn't argue that. But even if the court were to get there, I think the better interpretation is that Congress had in mind incentives. Otherwise, why would it have these huge numbers for production? Congress was making a guess itself.
You agree that EPA in this case did use the market forcing objective in determining what number within the range?
Well, I don't think that was not EPA's primary consideration. EPA.
No, but my question, if you could just answer the question exactly. You agree that EPA in this case did use a market forcing objective in picking the number within the range?
Within the range, yes. I think that was one of the factors. Once EPA considered, and I think the important distinction between my argument and API's is, how do you get that range? Because API's argument is EPA goosed up the range to get it to really get the industry going and to give the incentive. EPA set the range based on what the information showed was reasonable that would actually be produced, not just a straight line continuation of what was produced, but what was a reasonable, rational estimate of what actually could be produced. And then, yes, within that range, they did, and I think it's perfectly okay for them to consider, well, Congress wanted us to give an incentive. But they didn't do this for everyone. For instance, if you take Zeachem was 50,000 gallons. The estimate for Zeachem was 50,000 gallons. And if you trace the development of that number, that was the low end of the range. The same thing for American Process. American Process, the range was 500,000 to 900,000. Well, EPA took the bottom of the range. So even though EPA was considering the need to Congress's desire for an incentive, that doesn't mean they took the top of the range. In most cases, they actually took the bottom of the range when given a range. Now, that range was different than EIA, but I think that feeds into the back and forth about Judge Kavanaugh, what do you do with EIA? I think petitioners said, well, EIA is the expert. You should really defer to EIA. If EPA had done nothing except the projection from EIA, I wonder if we would be here, because the difference is so small. We're talking about $1 million. $1.3 million is basically...
They have several arguments. That's one of them.
That is one of them, but I think it's important to keep in mind where the difference is, because they want you to look at millions of gallons estimated, zero actually produced. But I don't think that's the relevant inquiry. The relevant inquiry is the information EPA had in front of it, including from EIA itself, was that millions of gallons would be produced. And so EPA estimated millions of gallons would be produced. Now, sure, they ended up wrong, and they estimated a little bit more than EIA, and we can debate over whether it's a little bit or a lot, but really it's eight odd million gallons versus
6.6 versus 6.9. That's
6.9, right. So
sizable.
It's 25% if you look at that.
25% off is usually considered sizable.
It depends. Not compared to 500 million gallons, which is what.
Well, I agree with that. Yeah.
Well, that's where Congress said to start.
Yes.
So EPA moves down, and so does EIA. But when. And then the differences get even smaller when you look at particular facilities. For some facilities, for one facility, EPA actually estimated lower than what EIA did, because it said EIA said 3.1 million. EPA said, no, I think 3 is the better number.
It's interesting. They find that they have seriously overestimated the production for 2011, seriously overestimated vis-a-vis the real world, mm-hmm. and significantly overestimated vis-a-vis EIA, and they respond to those two interesting data points by doing it again.
And
certainly doing the second again. We can't say until 2012 is over that they did it with respect to the first issue, sort of overdoing reality.
Well, and if that were all they did, then that would be a bigger problem. But that's not all. They didn't just say, well, you know, we're going to turn a blind eye. They did look at each facility. And they asked, well, in two cases the facilities were the same. And the other six were different. And they asked, well, what's the current situation? And I don't think you can fault EPA for saying, all right, granted, they didn't make it, but what's changed? What's their financing today? What's their expected start of construction date today? And when you, I think that's the relevant place to analyze the record, not just say, well, they were wrong, therefore it's arbitrary to do anything to do anything other than say zero, because there is no actual production. That's not what EIA did, and petitioners concede the EIA, well, they say they're the expert, we say it's an important factor, but that's certainly not what EIA did. I think there's an important contradiction in their argument if they want to say anything but zero is arbitrary. I think the real question is, how did EPA justify its distinction, its differences between the EIA, and I think the record supports that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did council have any time left?
No time left.
All right. Well, we will give you 2 minutes if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'm told that the 20,000 gallons was used for the transportation fleet at the Rio Plus 20 environmental conference. So that's what it was used for. EPA argues, look at their explanation in the final rule and see if it's a reasonable explanation. And I'd say that's fair enough. But I submit, if you look at their explanation, they do go facility by facility, but they don't have any reasonable explanation of why they are accepting the predictions of these facilities when all the experience shows that there are going to be delays, there are going to be setbacks, and in their rather lengthy rule, they just...
I understand that argument. The difficulty is how would an agency trying to get it right go about the process?
Well, an agency that was trying to get an honest prediction, you know, that they thought this would really be the right number, they would have to have some sort of approach to recognize that nobody's been able to do this yet. Many very sophisticated people have tried, and they've run into various kinds of serious problems. So they could say, you know, we're going to wait until somebody produces at a commercial level, and then very shortly after they do, we'll project a large amount.
They're required by statute, although apparently they don't observe it, they're required by statute to have the projection in November 30th, right, before the year has started.
That's right.
So, I mean, it does seem as if Congress putting in those dates imposed on EPA the burden of projecting on the basis of what was necessarily going to be incomplete data.
Well, it turns out it's not that much of an imposition because they haven't actually issued their prediction by November 30th. But again, you know, part of this, if they were to ever undershoot for a year, I think we're correct, and I didn't hear of the, I mean, EPA concedes the RINs are good for 2 years, and there's no doubt at all that the requirements will be going up in the next year. Everybody agrees once these serious technical problems are solved. Absolutely. The requirements are in effect. So.
Sorry. You seem to want to put a thumb on the scale such that they undershoot.
No. And if I'm giving that impression, I
well, based
apologize.
On the past experience, at least.
No. All we are suggesting, all we are arguing is that it needs to be reasonable. And as we talked about earlier, we're not asking the court to pick a number or to put a ceiling, but to say, what is fundamentally unreasonable about this rule is that you had experience in 2010, you had experience in 2011, you even had an expert agency that was recognizing there were going to be delays and setbacks, although, you know, experience showed they weren't recognizing it enough, but they were trying to.
Didn't their evaluation of 2012 take into account, in some respect, because there are the delays and setbacks?
No. I mean, that's, again, if you look at their rule, they say, okay, now we're going to come up with our prediction. Here's what this facility.
I agree on the face it doesn't.
Okay.
But derivatively, the facilities are making projections that are based on, okay, here's been our past experience. Here's what we expect in the future. EIA is doing the same. And.
Well, but a facility is never going to say, you know, we're finished construction. We don't know of any delays or setbacks now, but but nevertheless we'll predict that something's going to come up and we'll be delayed by six months or a year. That's not, you know. They're trying to get their business going and attract investors.
But any realistic projection from a facility, and the facility does have other obligations to try to project accurately, presumably, the publicly traded ones, is going to take account what's the realistic possibility we can overcome the likely delays and setbacks. And they come up with a number, and then EPA relies to some extent.
Many of these companies, I think, are not publicly traded. I mean, ironically, a few of them actually submitted comments to EPA saying, you know, in your proposed rulemaking, there's no way we can make that much, which is truly extraordinary. And EPA did, to its credit, on those say, well, all right, we'll come down to the absolute maximum that we think. And even, you know, for one, they said, well, we'll go at the low end. But they never went below what any facility.
But doesn't that show that the companies are taking into account the things that are going to prevent them? You call them delays and setbacks. They're not taking into account the unknown unknowns, but the known unknowns.
Well, but that may be a very good way to put it, Your Honor. But the fact is, having lived through 2010 and 2011, we're not dealing with purely unknown unknowns anymore. We have real-world experience. And I think at the end of the day, really what we're asking the court to do is to say that EPA is required to learn from experience and take some account of this experience. Thank you.
Case will be submitted.